Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to IPVMB. Hope everybody is doing great. I've been having an interesting few weeks. I'm currently calling it the weapons curse. Weapons as in that new horror slash thriller movie that came out a few weeks ago. Every single weekend I'll have planned to see it. And I'll be all like, okay, tomorrow's my day off, gonna see it tomorrow or maybe the day after. And boom, I'll wake up in the morning, I get sick. It keeps happening to me. I don't know what's going on. The first weekend when it came out, I just had like, just felt like a really bad cold. Then was fine the rest of the week at work. I was like, okay, I'm gonna go see it again this weekend. And then, boom, I have the worst chesty cough, which I still kind of have. And why I have been putting off recording this episode, because I have now gotten, the chestiness is gone and I feel better and I'm not sick anymore. But I have that annoying, like, leftover, like, tickly cough. You know, when you feel it at the back of your throat, you'll say a couple of sentences and suddenly you're, like, coughing uncontrollably. So that's been fun. And then last weekend, so bizarrely, I was at work on Saturday night before my day off, and came back from my break. And I work quite late. I don't finish till 10 every night. And out of nowhere after my lunch, I got the most horrendous pain in my foot. Like, it was so bad. I couldn't move it. It was swollen. Really tender to touch. It was awful. I had to like get myself into our back area and just sit down and ice it for like an hour, and then had to Uber all the way home because I could not walk on it. And it didn't get injured or anything, but I suspect it may be. So I have a bunion on that foot, and it's not been like crazy painful, like off and on throughout the years, maybe here and there. It's more like it'll be kind of tender a little bit, but it's not like constantly in pain. But I think lately it's been getting painful, and I think because I've been keeping the weight off of that side of my foot, so now and all the pain from this one was on the other side of the foot, so I think that's kind of what was causing it. So once again, I could not go to see Weapons. And yeah. And then this weekend, I said, you know what? I'm not going to make any plans to see it. I'm just giving up. I'm just going to wait till it comes out on streaming. It can't be that long away now. And I made no plans suddenly. I feel perfect. I'm fine. I feel great. But I'm, for some reason, just not in the mood to go to the movie theater. So I'm just like, yeah, I don't know. I'm calling it the weapons curse. You might think I'm crazy. I am maybe a little bit crazy. But my foot's okay right now. I'm going to go back and get it checked out. But yeah, so I don't know. The last month has been it's been interesting. I don't know. But anyways, other than that, everything has been pretty good. I have some stuff going on right now that is exciting. But I can't talk about it right now. But I will talk about it in a future episode. So stay tuned for that. Today's episode is actually a re-record of a previous episode I did maybe like a year ago, maybe a little bit longer. And I recorded it with my first guest, which was my sister, Tamara. But I don't know, I just felt like the audio was not great and I wanted to re-record it. And, you know, I was so hesitant about it because it is one of my most listened to episodes. But I have this thing in my head where I keep thinking I want to go back and re-record my old episodes. Mostly, not so much the ones where I'm telling other people's stories, but like the very early days when I'm talking about my own story. But like, obviously it's a lot of work. I still have like the scripts and everything that I wrote out for the episode because I write everything down and prepare it beforehand, even when it's my own story, because I tend to forget things. And I think about it a lot because I know the audio is terrible and just, you know, I was very new to this and I don't know, I think about it sometimes, but I don't know. What do you think, guys? Let me know. I know maybe you haven't listened to those episodes, or, you know, you dip in and out when you hear, because I know I have a lot of listeners who listen based on what the subject is about. And then I have some people that have listened literally since the start. So I don't know. Give me your opinions, because I need to know. I'm not sure. I just like, I get these ideas in my head and then when I'm going to execute it, I tend to get like, oh, I regret this immediately, but you're kind of too far gone to do anything about it. It's like the other week I bought this gorgeous mirror from Five Below. First of all, I'm obsessed with Five Below. I had left work early for whatever reason. I know there was a reason why. I was probably like not feeling great. So actually, yeah, I think it was that I was not feeling great. And this is maybe like, what, a month ago or so. And I was like waiting. I had some time in between my trains. I was like, let me go to Five Below. It's right by my train station. And we like bopping. Of course, there was a couple of things I needed in there. And, you know, there's always the inevitable things that you just pick up. And I saw as soon as I walked in, and I had seen it on TikTok previously, because that's where I discover everything nowadays. But it is just this gorgeous, like, vintage looking full length mirror. It's got a gold frame. I'm actually staring at it right now as I'm recording this. Kind of that like floral leaf kind of design around. It's just, it's beautiful. And I saw it and it was $35. And I was like, oh my God, I really want this. So this is when, so I was in the city, so I'm a good like train ride away from my house, and I was like, oh, I really want it, but like I cannot bring this home by myself. Now it's quite heavy, but like you could definitely carry it, no problems. But I'm also like, I'm not taking a mirror onto the train. Like there's absolutely no way. I'm not going to be one of those people. And I kind of had it in my head, okay, let me see if I can get it delivered from somewhere. So I had I got on the train and I immediately went on to all the usual delivery apps, I think. And, you know, I was trying to find like who has it in stock and how much, you know, each, you know, because all the apps and everything have like different delivery fees and all of that, or like a minimum delivery, whatever. So I found, I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was Instacart, and went on Instacart, ordered it, and I was like, there's no way they're gonna have it. I feel like the person who's going to get it will walk in and it's not gonna be there, or else they're gonna realize, oh, it's a full length mirror, and just not want to bring it with them, because most of the people have like cars, bikes, whatever, and I wasn't sure it would be like able to fit easily. But anyways, my guy, and I swear when I think about him, I send all the positivity out to him all the time. He picked it up. I think I got it within an hour. And I went outside to him and he just has it in his car. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. It was probably really annoying to put in your car. He was like, no, it's no problem. And he was saying, like, it's such a gorgeous mirror. I'm thinking about getting it myself. Like, he was so nice. But anyways, getting to that. And I think all together with tipping out. And I gave him an extra tip too, because I was like, it was so, he was just so lovely. And he really like, he packed it with care as well, and I really appreciated that. So like I think it ended up costing maybe an extra like 50 $15 or something, because I have free Instacart anyway, like delivery and stuff. So maybe an extra $15. I can't really remember 100% onto what the mirror costs. But honestly, if you see this mirror, it is worth the extra cost of it. Because I know, like, you know, when you order something and you're like, oh my God, this is such a good deal, but then you have to pay like shipping fee or whatever, and it's like, okay, well, now it's more expensive or immediately. But like, this is so cheap because mirrors are so expensive. I've been looking for like a really nice full-length mirror. I have one, but it's like one of those really skinny ones. I want a really nice full-length mirror for so long, and like, they're so expensive. But this is $35, so I think maybe like 50 or something. I think I paid altogether. Totally worth it. But anyways, that all is to get to the fact that I was trying to figure out, okay, where am I going to put it? And I had the perfect spot, perfect wall in my living room slash kitchen. And I'm very lucky. I have a 2-bedroom apartment. I live by myself, and it's a very big apartment. I'm very, very lucky. And I found the perfect wall, and I was like, okay, but if I move this, if I put this mirror here, I'm gonna have to move. I have two bookshelves now. If you know me, my house is basically made up of books. I have so many books, it's ridiculous. And I have a lot of little like trinkets and things. My apartment is very like cluttercore, like organized, but with a lot of clutter, but it's organized clutter. And I was like, okay, I've got two bookshelves that are against that wall to move, the picture frames on the wall, and then all of the randomness that is on top of the bookshelves, like little ornaments and vases and randomness. So I had a plan in my head about how I was going to move it. Now, mind you, I was sick this weekend, so I knew I couldn't start it. But when I get something in my head, all I want to do is just execute it right away. But I was like, no, don't do it. Don't do it, because you're too sick and you're going to get halfway through and it's a big job and it's not going to be fun. So then what was annoying was that I was then going into a 5-day work week, so I knew I wouldn't be able to the following weekend. But I had 2 days off together, so I was like, okay, that's enough time to execute the plan. So I basically like wrote down where I was going to put everything, where I was going to move everything to, and do it one bit at a time, so then it wouldn't be a big deal, because I didn't want like everything just pulled out and all over the place, you know. So I figured out where I was putting everything, so it ended up with me wanting to have to move a lot of stuff into my bedroom. And I kind of was okay with that because I had wanted to move my bedroom around for a while, but I also was aware of the fact that like it was going to be a huge job because I have so much stuff in my bedroom. Like I said, my bedroom is basically the size of like an apartment by itself in New York standards. Now, I ain't trying to brag to all my New Yorkers here, but like I am very lucky. I have a very big apartment. But I was like, okay, I need to like do this. And it would involve moving my bed, and my bed is also, it's just big and heavy, and it has like, you know, and it has like all those little parts like the bed frame, whatever. It's like, oh God. So anyways, following weekend, I did the first part. So I did all the living room stuff the first weekend, got that part done, hung the mirror. I was very cautious about the mirror because I'm not one of those people who's just, I ain't drilling into my wall, I ain't hanging no nails. I'm a command strips girly, like strictly. Everything that's hung on my apartment, it's a command strip or a command hook. So I was like, if I buy enough command strips, I think this mirror will stay on the wall. And it's been like a month now, and it's still there. Now, if you saw the back of it and the amount of command strips I have on there, and I kept like every time I would come home from work, I'd peep because it's right in my front door. I'd like peep around the corner to see that it was still there. Lo and behold, it still is. Thank Jesus, because I was really like having thoughts of coming home and like the mirror is going to be smashed all over the floor. But it hasn't, and I don't think it will. It seems pretty solid where it is now. So shout out to the command strips. Love them. So yeah, so did that the first weekend, quite liked what I had done with the place, stuffed everything into my bedroom until I could deal with that mess. Then, like I said again, I was sick again the following weekend. So on my first day off, I was like, I can't do anything, I'm too sick. And then on the following day, I was still sick, but I was like, you know what? I have to get this done because it's making me crazy. So I spent 8.5 hours reorganizing my bedroom. 8.5 hours. And I still wasn't finished. So what did I do? I took a half day from work the next day. And I spent several more hours finishing off. The night before, my room was so disorganized, I slept on the couch because I was like, I can't sleep amongst chaos. I can't sleep in a messy room. I don't know how people do it, but I couldn't sleep with the chaos. So yeah, so basically, yeah, everything is done now. I just have some things to hang on the walls in my bedroom, but that's like fine. That's easy work. But yeah, all of that was to say that once I get a plan in my head, I have to execute it. But sometimes halfway through, I'm full of regrets. And that leads back to my original thought on this, which was, do I re-record the early podcast episodes or not? Answers on a postcard. Let me know. You know how to contact me. But anyways, sorry for the really long story about nothing. That means nothing to you guys. But to me, it means an awful lot. But here we are. So
this is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Anyways, I'm going to get on with the episode now, I promise you. So this is the re-recorded episode of The Story of Kerry Katona. So Kerry Katona, if you don't know her, for all my listeners outside of like certain parts of you, Europe, certainly, I know people in the UK and Ireland will definitely know who she is. Like, she's a really, really well-known person. I'd say you'd be hard pushed to find anyone in at least the UK or Ireland who wouldn't know who she is. And she started out as a pop star in a girl group, and then she just kind of like became this TV personality. She's very, very likable. She's been through an awful lot, a lot of things that, you know, aren't great. She's not done a lot of great things, but she's just one of those people who had a terrible childhood and just kind of never quite seemed to get herself together. These days, thankfully, she seems like she's in a much better place, but she's like, she's just a very likable person and seems very like down to earth, normal. I think that's people, why people kind of take to her so much, and why she's been in the spotlight for so long, is I think that like a lot of people just really want her to be okay and to like do well. But yeah, so anyways, like I said, this is a re-record of her story. If you've heard it already, I did, it's not the exact same like script that I use. This is kind of like a rewrite of it, because I didn't want to make it exactly the same. And hopefully the sound quality is far better than the last one. It is quite noisy where I'm recording today. I just could not find a quiet spot because there's a lot going on in my neighborhood today for some reason. But anyways, let's get on with it. So Kerry Katona was born on September 6, 1980 in Warrington, Cheshire, which is in the UK. Her early life was turbulent, with her being placed in foster care and raised by several different families. Her mother, Sue, struggled with bipolar disorder and substance abuse, shaping much of Kerry's childhood. At just 16, Kerry left school and began working as a lap dancer before finding fame in 1998 as part of the original lineup of girl group Atomic Kitten. Atomic Kitten had some good tunes. I kind of liked their like very early stuff. They did a lot of like cover versions as well. Like, they're probably, their most known song would be Hole Again. That was like massive when it came out. So in 2001, she left the group after becoming pregnant by her partner Brian McFadden of Westlife and facing tensions within the band. It's safe to say that I think Atomic Kitten, well, like, they always did very well. I think once Kerry started dating and then married Brian McFadden of Westlife, like, Westlife were such a huge group at the time, And for anyone who doesn't know, they're in a boy band from Ireland, still together, but Brian is no longer part of the group, hasn't been in the group for years, actually. But I think she was basically like the reason why they really became well known, because of when they started dating and whatever. And then people kind of paid more attention to them, and then they just kind of became massive. Like, again, once I said that song, Whole Again came out, and I think that was right before she left, and then a new member joined. So they became like really big after that. So since then, as I said earlier, Kerry has remained in the public eye, appearing on numerous reality shows. I remember she won I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here 1 year. Again, if you don't know what that show is, it's like a British reality TV show where celebrities go into the Australian jungle and they compete on all these like crazy challenges to be like crowned king or queen of the jungle. It's actually very, very good. She's published books, and she speaks openly about her battles with addiction and her own diagnosis of bipolar disorder. So Kerry never felt truly at home in the spotlight. It was a world that never quite fit. Before fame, all she had known was pain and abandonment, abuse, addiction, a childhood marked by instability, and a mother who needed mothering herself. Now in her mid-30s and a mother of five, Kerry found herself with another abusive man, a man she loved deeply. She believed the hurt was her fault, that somehow she had brought it on herself. So again, like, this is something that all victims of abuse feel at one point or other, that you caused it, that it's something that you're doing, that you deserve it, and all the rest of it. And then if you think about Kerry, who's already been through such a vulnerable like life already, like her childhood trauma, she's seeing her mother being abused, there's addiction, she has bipolar disorder, she's been with a lot of men who have just treated her terribly. So at some point you're going to think like, well, this is me, like, this is what I deserve, and this is, I'm causing this, you know. So Kerry met George in 2012, though they'd crossed paths before in their hometown of Warrington. He was known as Gorgeous George. He was tall, muscular, and intimidating on the outside, but surprisingly shy when you spoke to him, and he always made her laugh. On her 32nd birthday, while out for a cigarette with her mum Sue, George appeared. With a sparkle in his eye, he told her he'd just gotten back from holidays, which was to him a cheeky way of saying he had spent 6 years in prison. At the time, he claimed it was for fraud. Kerry would later learn it was for far more serious crimes. But she didn't flinch. She'd grown up around this type of chaos, around people with constant brushes with the law. To her, George felt safe. He was the kind of man no one would dare cross, and she found comfort in that. He made her laugh, and by the end of the night, they were kissing. And again, like, I can kind of understand that feeling of, like, you know, she's obviously someone who's been very vulnerable throughout her life and had a lot of things happen to her. And then, you know, you have this, like, big, muscly guy who no one messes with, and it's like, oh, he's going to take care of me, you know, he's going to protect me. So Kerry was falling fast, and their connection intensified quickly. The next day, they went on a date. Soon after, Kerry had to leave for a boot camp, and to her surprise, she missed him. He called her every day and even spent time with her mom while she was away, a gesture she now sees as an early sign of the possessiveness that would follow. When she returned, George came to her house and never left. Her kids adored him. He was playful, charming, and quickly won over her entire family. Kerry believed she'd found real love. He told her he loved her after a holiday they shared, and though she sensed he was troubled, she believed she could help him heal. She thought love would be enough. So George was a black man who had been adopted by a white couple, and though he rarely spoke about it, Kerry sensed the uncertainty around his identity had left deep scars within him. It was something they shared, a feeling of not quite belonging. In many ways, they were kindred spirits. What Kerry didn't know at first was that George was a drug addict. He hid it so well. She assumed he used steroids and occasionally partied with recreational drugs, nothing alarming. But the truth, which surfaced much later, was far darker. And it didn't take long for his violent side to emerge. One night, Kerry had friends over. They were laughing and joking about a silly kiss from years ago, just harmless fun. But Kerry saw something shift in George. The light went out in his eyes. He stormed off. Moments later, in the bedroom, he turned and hurled his phone at her head hard. She was stunned, more by the fact than the pain. Her oldest daughter, Molly, overheard everything and was deeply shaken. Kerry told George to leave and never come back, and he did. But then the familiar cycle began. Her mother, Sue, called. George had gone to her crying, saying he was sorry and that he loved Kerry. Sue urged her to forgive him, and Kerry, confused, heartbroken, desperate for love, started to wonder if she'd overreacted. His apology, his tears, the vulnerability of this man brought her back in. He returned, said sorry, and cried, and just like that, it was as if nothing had happened. So clearly he's gone, like, and you know, like she said in the beginning, that like he called into her mom while she was away, and you know, basically trying to make it seem like he's such a nice guy and his mom thinks he's a great guy, you know, looking and making sure I'm okay while my daughter's away. And then like he does something horrific to Kerry and then goes straight to her mom crying and sobbing because he's manipulating her mom, because he knows that she's going to then feel sorry for him and go to Kerry and convince her to take him back, which is exactly what happened. And again, like this, what I say countless times, they know exactly what they're doing. They're playing the game from the very, very beginning. Kerry and George decided to move back up north. By then, his temper was harder to ignore. He lashed out more often, but Kerry believed she could still change him. She clung to the good moments, hoping things would improve. But as is often the case in abusive relationships, the violence escalated. One day while viewing a house, Kerry told a light-hearted story about having dinner with Brian Adams and some friends. It was innocent, but George didn't see it that way. His demeanour changed instantly. On the drive home, with one hand on the steering wheel, he used the other to wrap around Kerry's neck, strangling her. She could barely breathe and thought she was going to die. He pulled over, dragged her out of the car by her hair, slammed her into the door, spat on her and drove off, leaving her bruised and terrified on the side of the road. She made her way to her mother's house, desperate for safety, but George tracked her down. He stood outside, screaming, then kicked the door in. It was the first time Kerry's mother Sue saw his true nature, and the first time she seemed to regret encouraging their reunion. She was shaken, begging Kerry to call the police, but Kerry refused. George was on probation and she feared the fallout, especially the media attention given her public history. Instead, Kerry did what she thought would keep things calm. She went back to him. Despite knowing his violent past, even against police, Kerry believed love could fix him. Every time he hurt her, she convinced herself it would be the last. She sent her mother pictures of her injuries just in case. Years later, Sue would admit that she lived in a fear of a knock at the door telling her Kerry had been killed. George's outbursts were unpredictable and terrifying. He once snuck back into the house after she had kicked him out and stood watching Kerry as she slept. Another time, he threatened to rape and kill her mother. His behaviour was becoming more erratic and dangerous. In late 2012, Kerry began filming a show called The Big Reunion, which is where former pop bands come together for a second chance at fame. It was supposed to be her comeback after years of bad press. The show was a hit and Kerry loved being back with Atomic Kitten and old friends like the members of Boy Band Blue. On the surface, she was thriving, but behind the scenes, the violence at home was escalating. George had started showing up during filming. He wanted to be involved in every part of her life, even her work. One day, Kerry was joking around on set and briefly sat on her friend Anthony's lap, something innocent, just part of her being the life of the party. But she saw George watching and she knew what was coming. Later that night, back at the hotel, he exploded. He called her a slut, grabbed her by the hair, burning her scalp as he dragged her across the room. Then he locked her in the bathroom. She spent the night curled up in the bathtub, cold and terrified. The next morning, she was back on set filming a scene where the group sang around the piano. As the cameras rolled, she began to cry. The contrast was just too much. Just hours earlier, she'd been assaulted, and now she was expected to perform like nothing had happened. But still, she didn't leave. The violence wasn't constant. It came in waves. And in between, George was loving, funny, and kind. She clung to that side of him, telling herself it was just a bad week, that the man she loved would come back. He wasn't a monster all the time, and that was enough to keep her there. 7 months into the relationship, George proposed to Kerry on top of Blackpool Tower. It was romantic. He even involved the kids. A small part of Kerry believed marriage might change things, that the abuse would stop. Despite everything, she still saw him as her forever. Part of her rush to marry came from fear. George's ex had resurfaced and Kerry was terrified of losing him. Everyone seemed to want him and he knew it. He played into her jealousy, feeding it, using it to keep her close and off balance. Then just 3 months after the proposal, Kerry found out she was pregnant. They were both thrilled. George even had tattooed a K behind his ear, and Kerry got a matching G. He was desperate for a boy, saying girls were too much trouble. But still, the violence didn't stop. Even while she was pregnant, George continued to abuse her, pushing her, kicking her, spitting in her face. Afterwards, he'd apologise, say he loved her, then calmly explain it was her fault for provoking him, and somehow she ended up apologising to him. When Kerry was heavily pregnant, they had an electrician over to set up a new TV bed. She was sitting on the edge of the bed while he worked when George walked in. She knew instantly. The air in the room changed. Without a word, George ordered the electrician out, his tone sharp and dangerous. The moment the door shut, he turned on Kerry. He grabbed her by the throat, lifted her off her feet, and slammed her against the wardrobe. "You think it's okay to sit on our bed with another fucking man in my bedroom?" he spat. Kerry tried to explain. The electrician was just showing her how the TV worked, but George screamed, "Don't fucking lie to me," as his grip tightened. She begged him to stop, to think of the baby, that he could be hurting it, but he didn't care. He kept squeezing until she couldn't breathe, then dropped her to the floor. Kerry curled into a ball, sobbing. George spat on her again and walked out. Despite this, Kerry believed things were in a good place when their daughter, DJ, was born on April 4th, 2004. She was starting to accept the violence as part of George, convinced she could live with it, and still holding on to hope he'd change now that his daughter had arrived. DJ was born with six...
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Six fingers on each hand, just like George has. But within seconds, she was taken away. She wasn't breathing. At the same time, doctors told Kerry she needed emergency surgery. George was given a choice. Go with his wife or his newborn daughter. He chose Kerry. "I don't even know the baby. I'm sticking with my wife," he said. Like, that's just so disturbing to me, because, you know, when you become a parent, now, I don't know, I'm not a parent, but I feel like your priority, like every single parent I've ever heard of has said, your priority is always your child. And even your spouse becomes second to that. But there's an understanding there, right? Because I feel like Kerry, if she had known, would have wanted him to go with their child. But he picks Kerry. And again, it goes to show there's no real love there between him and Kerry, between him and his daughter. It's the control thing. He wants to go with her because she's the person, she's his victim, she's the one that he has the control over, and that's like his obsession, right? So both Kerry and DJ thankfully turned out to be okay, but emotionally Kerry was wrecked. Later, when she asked George how he felt during the ordeal, he replied, "I honestly thought you were going to die, and I wondered who the hell would pay the rent." So like, whether you say that in a joking way or not, that's so sick and disturbing and messed up to say, like, that was your priority. Disgusting. Kerry couldn't shake the thought that the abuse during her pregnancy might have contributed to DJ's traumatic birth. The stress and trauma drove her back to drinking, 3 bottles of Prosecco a day just to cope. George seized control of everything, feeding the baby, the school runs, shopping, cooking. Kerry lost all of her independence, and her drinking gave him ammunition to call her an alcoholic and a bad mother. But he would buy bottles of alcohol, place them in front of her, and then when she drank, he'd berate her for it. Exactly. Again, he was controlling her, and again, he was always going to come out on top. George's drug use was now out of control. He was clearly taking a lot of cocaine, and when he was on a bender, his mental health spiraled, but Kerry couldn't stop him. When DJ was just 3 months old, George was sectioned under the Mental Health Act after running through the streets screaming that someone was trying to kill him. He was darting in and out of traffic, yelling threats at no one in particular. Kerry was mortified by the public spectacle, but also terrified for his safety. The police issued a statement after a concerned neighbour called for help. Another neighbour told the press that George's behaviour was frightening. He was released shortly after with no further action. Kerry later learned he had suffered the equivalent of 3 heart attacks, having mixed steroids, sleeping pills and alcohol. In an interview to control the media fallout, George claimed he was heartbroken for what he had put Kerry through. He blamed it on a chemical imbalance, saying he had no sense of awareness during the rampage. But Kerry knew better, but she went along with the narrative to keep the peace. Seeing him so vulnerable made her feel protective. They both tried to move on. Kerry, desperate for happiness, decided to throw an extravagant wedding, which was covered by OK magazine. She still had doubts. Having a baby hadn't changed George, but she clung to the hope that marriage would. Even she knew she was lying to herself. And again, like, this is something we see countless times. You fool yourself so many times as thinking it's because this is happening. He's stressed, he's worried, he's whatever. And when this happens, everything will be great. We just need to get this point and everything great. And then you get to that point and then it's something else and it's something else and it's something else. George wouldn't let Kerry have a bachelorette party / hen party, whatever you want to call it, without him. Again, control. So they organised a joint stag and hen do. They spent the day in South London with OK Magazine documenting it. Around 30 guests enjoyed spa treatments, dinner, drinks and a boat trip on the Thames in London. Kerry was anxious but enjoyed brief moments of freedom chatting with her friends, knowing George was nearby but not hovering. It didn't last. She had begged him not to take drugs that day, but when he eventually showed up, he was clearly high. Before boarding the boat, Kerry returned to the hotel to freshen up, accompanied by her manager, Paul. George stormed in and went straight for Paul, threatening to beat him up, his spit flying as he shouted. Paul cowered in the corner, trembling. George accused Kerry of ignoring him all day, twisting the truth as always. She fired back, telling him he had been off with his friends doing God knows what. George told her not to backchat him and stormed out. Later, she found out he had taken his friends clubbing while a boat full of guests waited to set sail. Humiliated and heartbroken, Kerry told everyone the cruise was off. Alone in the hotel room, she watched social media posts of George partying with another woman. She kept ringing him, but he didn't answer. The next morning, he still hadn't returned. Kerry, fuming, threw all his clothes into the hotel bathtub and filled it with water. It was a small act of revenge. Then she drove to her mother's house. George's mother called, begging Kerry not to marry him. She warned Kerry he was a drug addict who would destroy her. Imagine, like, his own mother is saying this about her. And I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this before, but I am so sure now that my ex's mother tried to, on several occasions, warn me about him, or at least find out if he was treating me okay. But George tracked Kerry down, made her get in his car and drove her home. Hours later, she learned her grandmother had passed away. The grief of that loss overshadowed the disaster of the stag and hen party. Despite everything, the wedding day itself went smoothly. They had a brilliant time, though Kerry later learned that George had wanted to run away the night before. Whether it was the drugs or cold feet, she didn't know. She stayed quiet and got on with it. The speeches, however, were bizarre. George's brother told a disturbing story about George accidentally ripping a chicken's head off while trying to rescue it. Like, major red flags. His best man then joked about George's substance abuse, handing Kerry a parcel labelled, "Please ensure George wears this straitjacket the next time he goes on a drink and steroid bender." I mean, what the hell? So messed up. Like, his friends think that that's funny. It's just so weird. Oh, and I forgot to say that the label he had put on it, he made it seem like it was written and signed by Chief Inspector Smith, West Wickham Police. So he was like writing it from that point of view. Like, it's just so weird. So the crowd roared with laughter. Kerry laughed too, but deep down she felt sick. None of it was funny. In his own speech, George thanked Kerry for putting up with him. She couldn't stop herself from adding, "That's an understatement," as the guests cheered. They were all making light of something that had nearly destroyed her. For a while, life seemed to settle as Kerry and George adjusted to married life with their blended family of seven. But the next 2 years would become the darkest of Kerry's life. George's drug dependency deepened and his psychosis worsened. The children rarely saw the violence directly, but they heard the screaming and saw Kerry's black eyes. None of them spoke about it. Kerry felt ashamed, convincing herself they weren't suffering, that it wasn't as bad as her own childhood. But deep down, she knew that wasn't true. Pain is relative, and they were enduring their own version of trauma. She hated herself for staying with George and exposing them to that. Around this time, their relationship became a cycle of breakups and reconciliations. Kerry would get a few days away, sometimes weeks, of peace before taking him back. Things would be good for a while, then the violence would start again. George would hit her and sneer, "Happy now? You pushed me into it." He blamed her for pushing his buttons, saying she was like a red rag to a bull. But Kerry had started to fight back. She began calling the police. One night, after a particularly violent argument, she phoned them again. George was high on cocaine most nights, his paranoia becoming dangerous. Calling the police felt like the only way to protect her family. But every time, after the warnings and the statements, Kerry would back down and the cycle continued. The press began to notice the cracks. In May 2015, after yet another breakup, George gave an interview admitting their marriage was struggling. He said they argued over money, described their relationship as fiery, and admitted there were times he wondered if they should be together at all. But he insisted he loved Kerry and was determined to make it work. Behind closed doors, his cruelty escalated. He now targeted Kerry's eldest daughter, Molly, calling her degrading names, mocking her to the point that she isolated herself in her room. Kerry dismissed it as banter at the time, a decision she now deeply regrets. Her son Max was terrified of George. He started acting out at home and school. George would insult Max and his sister Heidi, referring to them as the druggies' kids because they were Kerry's children with her ex, Mark Croft, who was a drug dealer. He called Molly and Lily the Golden Girls for being Brian McFadden's daughters, which is just like so fucked up to start messing with kids and then trying to say that, like, oh, you're the Golden Kids because your dad is like famous also, and then you guys are just like nothing but the druggies' kids because your dad's a drug dealer. Like, it's just so sick, these poor little babies. Max witnessed some of the abuse. He once saw George grab Kerry in a chokehold and spit on her after getting out of the car. Another time, George had Kerry on her knees in the bedroom, her hands pinned above her head, when Max walked in. George told the frightened boy that his mother was trying to kill him. Kerry, desperate to calm him, told Max they were just playing and sent him out of the room. But it was DJ, their youngest, who alarmed Kerry the most. As a toddler, DJ began mimicking George's behaviour, spitting, hitting and kicking Kerry when she was frustrated. George didn't see it as a problem. Kerry suspected he was even proud of how much DJ mirrored him. Eventually, Kerry left George again and moved to a new town, renting a house surrounded by neighbours. It felt safer than the isolation of their previous home, where no one could hear her screaming. But George kept visiting. He was on his best behaviour now that they were separated, but Kerry was hesitant to let him move back. Still, they continued sleeping together. She felt powerless, pathetic, clinging to the hope he might change. George's behaviour grew even stranger. He became obsessed with black magic, often locking himself in the bathroom to perform rituals. Kerry would find piles of dead flies there. He called her his devil angel while casting spells. By October 2015, George was living with Kerry again. The beatings became routine, but now weapons were in the house. A taser gun and a 14-inch hunting knife hidden in the closet. One night after drinking at their local pub, George got into a fight with two young men. They ran off when Kerry warned them he would kill them. Back home, George was still seething. He pulled out the hunting knife, claiming the men were coming to their house. When Kerry told him they weren't, he punched her in the face, calling her a cunt. He ripped a chunk of hair from her scalp, leaving a bald patch, then dragged her through the house, kicking and spitting on her. He eventually went upstairs, waiting for his imaginary enemies to show up. Kerry spent the night trembling on the sofa where her daughter Lily found her the next morning. Without a word, Lily silently covered Kerry's bruises with makeup. Kerry was due to appear on Big Brother's Bit on the Side a few days later, but George told her she couldn't go on TV looking like that. He called her manager Paul and lied, claiming Kerry had drunkenly fallen down the stairs and couldn't do the show. Kerry knew Paul wasn't fooled. She took photos of her injuries and sent them to her mother and Paul, but deleted them quickly, fearing George would find them. Her breaking point came on a Friday family movie night. George went out to buy cigarettes but was gone for an hour, returning with Prosecco instead. Suspicious, Kerry accused him of getting drugs. He denied it, but his behaviour was familiar, childlike, sheepish. She told him to leave, but he went upstairs. Kerry slept on the sofa again, knowing something was coming. The next morning, she found him in the bedroom, crouched in a corner, snorting cocaine at 8 a.m. She handed him a beer to calm him down and took the kids to a playground, trying to keep things normal. When they returned, George was pacing the kitchen, eyes vacant, muttering about monsters in his phone. Kerry stayed calm, gently leading him upstairs. Then the phone rang. It was the police. There had been a missed call from the house. She knew George had made it. Moments later, George picked up the other line and told them, "My wife is trying to murder me." Kerry's stomach dropped. She called her neighbour Amelia to take the kids and hid in the utility room. The sirens came fast. George's history meant any call-out was treated as a high threat. Police coaxed him out. He was rambling about monsters. Kerry, on speaker with George's mother, told the police everything. The knife, the taser, the years of abuse. Once she started talking, she couldn't stop. An order was placed to keep George away. The police installed lights around Kerry's home and gave her a panic alarm. A domestic abuse support worker, Tracy, told Kerry, "You don't have to live like this. This isn't normal." That conversation sparked something in Kerry. For the first time, she considered leaving for good. I always come back to this woman whose name I don't even know, but she was a social worker that I spoke to for like 10 minutes, literally right after I walked out of that apartment with my ex for the last time. And within that like 10 minute conversation, couldn't have been more than that, I instantly felt like, oh my God, like I remember the weight kind of lifting off of me. Like, you understand, like she was saying things before I even had a chance.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
She was kind of like, does he do this and does he say that and does he do this? And I was like, oh my God, yes, he does do that. He does. Like, how do you know? How do you know? Like, I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that this is a pattern. This is something that they do. This is like a particular type of person and their behavior and how they act. And I was like, oh, so it isn't just me causing things, or it isn't just him. It's like, this is actually something that happens. And I just remember being like, oh my God. So I know exactly here how Kerry feels in this moment. George was charged with assault and possession of a banned weapon. He was out on bail and for a few weeks they stayed apart. But by January 2016, George had again wormed his way back in. They started meeting in secret and Kerry once again was pulled back in. When police came for a welfare check, George was hiding in the house. Kerry's Aunt Angela tried to warn them, but George grabbed her, hissing, "Don't say a fucking word." If he'd been caught, he would have been arrested immediately. Kerry dropped the charges and reconciled with him. To this day, she struggles to explain why. She was codependent, numb, and in her mind, it felt safer having him where she could see him. The idea of him out there plotting and stalking was worse. With the charges dropped, George now felt invincible. His cruelty worsened. The good times became fewer, the fear constant. Carrie was trapped in a cycle she couldn't break. By 2017, things had reached breaking point. Carrie and George were fighting constantly. She'd come to believe she deserved the violence, but the kids were suffering and George's instability was escalating. Every day their lives were in danger. The more his true personality showed, the more repulsive he became to her. Yet despite despising him as a person, Carrie still felt a sexual pull towards him, her biggest weakness. An opportunity arose for Carrie to return to the TV show Big Brother for a celebrity task. The money wasn't great, but it would revive her career after the negative press surrounding George. At first, George agreed, but as the date approached, he turned. "You'll go on that show over my dead body," he said. The chauffeur was booked, the contract signed, but George wasn't going to let her leave easily. He sneered, "I take it you're going to pay me to look after the kids while you're gone." Then, in the most chilling tone, he warned, "Leave those kids with me and watch what fucking happens." Carrie broke down, locking herself in the spare room, unsure how she'd get out of the job. He followed her, hurling insults, mocking her career, and bragging that he was too good to work. In that moment, all she could see was his ugliness. She phoned her manager and pulled out of the show. She believed without a doubt that if she left, he would hurt the children. Molly's look of disappointment that day shattered Carrie. Her daughter had witnessed a man control her mother completely, and Carrie knew that moment would stay with her forever. It was no surprise when Molly decided to move to Ireland to live with her grandparents. She needed a normal life, free from chaos. Carrie put on a brave face but blamed herself for Molly's sadness. Losing her was the catalyst. Suddenly, the marriage wasn't worth it anymore. She knew she had to get out, for good this time. Around this time, a close friend, Danielle, lost her father. Danielle's sister, Mel B from the Spice Girls, had recently escaped an abusive marriage herself. Danielle's fear of losing her sister resonated with Carrie. She wondered if her children would feel the same fear for her. At the funeral, Carrie looked at the mourners and thought, "Would this be my fate next?" The premonition chilled her. She could no longer look at George without seeing what he really was, a con man who never paid his way. A switch had flipped. "I don't love him anymore," she confided in Danielle. It took a few more weeks of terrifying arguments before she found the courage to act. George would taunt her, "You're mine till I die, Carrie, mine." But in June 2017, George left with minimal resistance. She'd braced herself for violence, for him to trash the house or manipulate her with charm, but he just left. A part of her still longed for the version of George she had first fallen for, but she knew he wasn't coming back. Once he was gone, Carrie sat down with Lily and Molly and apologised. She told them she had done to them exactly what her own mother had done to her, something she'd sworn ever to repeat. The guilt was overwhelming. Carrie wanted George to remain in DJ's life through supervised visits, and she naively hoped he wouldn't hurt her. She also tried to shield Max and Heidi from the fallout. They'd always called George Daddy, even though he wasn't their biological father, but George's true colours showed. He discarded Max and Heidi completely, pretending they didn't exist. He only wanted DJ. Carrie was heartbroken watching her children try to understand why they were being rejected. George had become yet another father figure who abandoned them. It was the wound they would carry forever. A few weeks after the split, Carrie got the call that changed everything. George, high and out of control, had been spotted crawling naked on a rooftop in Liverpool, screaming at the top of his lungs. Up until then, he'd been calmer. DJ was still seeing him regularly, and Carrie had been feeling some peace with her decision to leave. He still had that charm when they crossed paths, and it took everything in her not to fall back into bed with him. She told herself she didn't love him anymore, maybe didn't even like him, but there was still that pull. Part of her even wondered if they might somehow work it out. But then came the rooftop incident. Her manager Paul rang to say the papers had footage. In it, George was frothing at the mouth, shouting, "Kill me." His voice more like a wounded animal than a man. The police were begging him to come down. He looked terrified, lost. Watching it, Carrie knew in her heart it was over for good. He needed help. Help she couldn't give him anymore. Once George realised she was truly done, he turned on her. He went to the press claiming she was the abusive one, the cause of all his problems. He said she was aggressive, that he'd had to call the police on her before. The lies cut deep, not just because of what he was saying, but because of how easily he could convince people with the slightest hint of guilt. Still, whenever they were in the same place, he'd try to draw her back in, and she knew she was vulnerable. So in what she calls a moment of madness, she started dating James English in September 2017. But she wasn't ready. She was still reeling from the trauma. James was charming, fun, and a distraction. She ignored reports about his past, including that he'd assaulted a woman because she wasn't looking for forever. And she knew if she slept with someone else, George would never come back. That, in her mind, was the way out. Within 2 weeks, she was pregnant. Shocked and overwhelmed, she booked an abortion but couldn't go through with it. She booked another, then a third, and still couldn't do it. Most nights, she cried herself to sleep, wishing for some accident to make the decision for her. She didn't feel connected to the pregnancy at all. She didn't want another child with another man. Eventually, she decided to keep the baby. When she learned it was a girl, she tried convincing herself it was the right choice, but the feelings didn't come. Then, before a work trip to India, she miscarried. She bled through the flight, ended up in hospital, and stayed behind to recover. It was a strange mix of emotions, grief but also relief, and a guilt she still carries. While she was in India, a close friend and her husband flew out to see her. Kerry was on morphine when the friend filmed her and posted it online with the caption, "This is Kerry Katona murdering her child." The betrayal was crushing. She had the video taken down, grateful that the press couldn't touch it because of the medical information, but the damage was done. She ended things with James immediately. He sold stories about her afterward. She figured he'd only wanted the attention. Even after everything, Kerry still found herself pulled back to George. She'd sworn she'd never go near him again, but his charm worked like a drug. They slept together a few more times, each encounter starting with him sweeping her up in the fantasy that maybe they belonged together, and ending with her reminding him they weren't a couple. She knew he was seeing other women. She knew he was using her to prove he could still have her whenever he wanted. So why does she keep going back? Self-sabotage, punishment, a deep belief that she somehow deserved the pain. Looking back now, she sees it differently. George is a man in crisis. He needs psychiatric help, rehab, maybe even prison just to force him to stop and get treatment. But in the moment, she was way too close to see that. By late 2017, the cycle finally began to break. George told the press he'd served her divorce papers, but in reality he'd sent a financial demand, a list of what he wanted from her. He had no intention of ending the marriage. Broken, exhausted, she begged him for a quick online divorce. He refused, turning up at her house to say she'd be his wife until the day he died. "But don't worry, Kerry," he added, "I will die." He'd been visiting spiritualist churches, getting psychic readings, convinced his death was coming. Over the next few weeks, things were calmer. Without the constant threat of violence, Kerry felt a flicker of renewed energy. She moved in with a friend while doing Panto in Manchester, grateful to have a safe haven for herself and the kids. George stayed mostly calm, though police were called a few times during handovers with DJ. Once, he refused to leave her friend's property, shouting and threatening because the handover was taking too long. DJ lasted only minutes with him before asking to come home, distressed. Kerry still believed he'd never physically harm his daughter, but cracks were beginning to show. By March 2018, almost a year after their final breakup, she was rebuilding her life. The hookups had ended that previous November. She even did a photo shoot with the kids for a magazine, proudly stating she'd never take George back. Then came Mother's Day. She FaceTimed George so DJ could say hello, but DJ, just 3 years old, wasn't in the mood to chat. Distracted, she wandered off. George saw it differently. He accused Kerry of turning his daughter against him. His smile darkened into a glare. Kerry felt the knots in her stomach tighten. This time, his anger was aimed at DJ, and that terrified her more than anything he'd done to her. "I read your magazine article," he spat. "You think you're so clever. Watch what happens next, Kerry." DJ's eyes widened. "DJ, hold on tight to your fucking mother. I'm coming to get you." Kerry begged him not to speak like that in front of their child. He looked at DJ again. "She can die with me." Kerry froze. He was threatening to kill his own daughter. His eyes were black, empty. He smirked. "How's your mum, Kerry? Is she all right?" Her blood ran cold. Was he planning to hurt DJ, her mother, both? She couldn't speak. She was gripped in an icy fear. "You just watch what happens," he said, winking before hanging up. That wink chilled her more than any beating ever could. At least then she knew what was coming, but now she didn't know if he'd show up at her door, at her mum's, or take DJ. Moments later, an email arrived. "Kerry, Why did you hang up when I was having a nice conversation with my daughter? Have you been taking your medication properly? Are you drinking again? I'll speak to my lawyer about this. She knew exactly what he was doing, writing in a way that seemed concerned to outsiders, but was really calculated to scare her and build a paper trail against her. Manipulation at its most insidious. With shaking hands, Kerry called the police, reported everything, and asked for a restraining order. Kerry pressed forward with the divorce, but she couldn't afford a solicitor. Her friend Danielle stepped up as her Mackenzie friend. A Mackenzie friend is someone who supports a person representing themselves in court, taking notes and whispering quiet advice from the sidelines. No legal training, just there to be loyal. George immediately tried to block it. His reason was as petty as it was outrageous. He claimed it was unfair because he'd been sleeping with Danielle. In court over a video link, Kerry listened to him say it out loud, almost smug, apparently not realising that he'd just admitted to infidelity while trying to claim spousal support from her when she had nothing. Then came his demands. £8,000 for tattoo removal, private holidays because he claimed he couldn't travel as a public figure. He'd even rubbed in lawyers by spinning them a fantasy about Kerry being secretly wealthy, promising them a big payday if they won. The proceedings went nowhere. George stopped turning up, eventually refusing to even acknowledge the divorce. And once the restraining order was granted, he disappeared from her life, at least in person. In 2018, Kerry was performing in Panto in Norwich, the very town where George was now living with his parents. Whispers started circulating backstage. George was planning to show up, knife in hand, drag her off stage and kill her because he wasn't allowed to see DJ. Every night she scanned the crowd, heart thundering, wondering if the next face she saw would be his. He never came. Later, a friend of George's told her the rest. He planned to inject DJ with heroin, then kill himself. A grotesque plan that included buying blue contact lenses so he could tell DJ, "My eyes turn blue like yours because I missed you." The thought of it was sickening. For the rest of that year, Kerry's fear never left her. She learned to walk quickly, to keep her head down and always check over her shoulder. And then, unexpectedly, a change. She met a man called Ryan on Bumble, a dating app. Kerry had sworn off men, determined to focus on healing and learning to live without the chaos. But sometimes the loneliness crept in. Ryan's picture caught her attention. His eyes were kind, open. He was 8 years younger, ambitious, and the complete opposite of the dangerous men she'd been drawn to before. They took things slowly, at her pace, because she still feared falling back into old patterns. When she was offered a show called Celebs Go Dating, no one knew her relationship with Ryan had deepened. Money was tight and she'd been made to feel her career was over, so she said yes, promising Ryan nothing romantic would happen. He wasn't jealous, he simply said, "Just make sure you come home to me every night." Working with the dating experts on the show became less about meeting someone new and more about rediscovering herself. A week after filming, she ended things with Ryan. He was devastated, but Kerry told herself she needed to stand on her own two feet. 2 weeks later, the quiet in her home felt heavy. She realised she had let go of something rare. Ryan wasn't like Brian or Mark or George. He was something different entirely. They got back together, and when she finally told him the truth about the abuse, about her childhood, he didn't make excuses or change the subject. He simply said, "I'm sorry you went through that." No man had ever said those words to her before, and in that moment, Kerry knew she'd found something worth keeping. To me here, and you know, we're going to get to the end of this story too, but I just feel like it's a little too much too soon. Like, it's too perfect. It's too kind of like, oh, I told him and he's fine with it. But like, that's what a normal person, how a normal person would react to someone hearing that. You know, I feel like, again, like she's kind of diving in too fast, and that just kind of seems to be a pattern with her. Now, I'm not trying to say that Ryan is an abusive man, because there's no evidence of that, and you know, I don't think that he is, but I just think from her point of view, again, like she's just moving too fast, you know. So Saturday, July 6, 2019, it had been a year now since Kerry last heard from George. Her phone lit up. It was a FaceTime from George's father. Her hands began to shake. He had no reason to be calling her. Something was wrong. She let it ring out, tried to push it away, but her mind wouldn't stop. "Does George have DJ? Is he anywhere near my kids?" She kept her doctor's appointment, but when she got back in the car, the phone was ringing again. Same name, same dread. Kerry called home. Everyone was there, Molly and Lily looking after the younger ones. She told Lily to lock the doors. Her heart was pounding now. Then her manager, Paul, rang. Before he could speak, she blurted it out. Are you calling me to tell me George is dead? Silence. Then, yes. She screamed, cried. Ryan pulled her close, but she felt more afraid than ever. How was she going to tell the kids? Her heart ached, for DJ and even for George. Now they would never see each other again. The truth was grim. George had been staying at a Holiday Inn, binging on cocaine. He'd been hallucinating, telling staff about wasps and shadows in his room. Guests complained he was wandering the corridors asking strangers to be his friend. Police had been called hours before his death. They found drugs, saw he wasn't right. He admitted using cocaine. A welfare check was done, but no arrest, no hospital. The next morning, housekeeping walked in to find him eating a ball of cocaine he hidden in a sock. Minutes later, he was collapsing. Paramedics rushed him to hospital, but it was too late. Drugs and mental illness had finally taken him. Kerry knew she'd done the right thing, cutting contact between George and DJ. He'd shown no signs of getting help, but guilt was still wrapped around her like a vice. She told the kids. Max and Heidi broke down. Lily was in shock. Molly sat still and silent. When she told 5-year-old DJ, the little girl just said, "Yes, Mummy," and kept playing with her toys. Even after everything, Kerry was still George's wife. She decided she had to see him one last time. She took her mother to the chapel arrest. The moment she saw him, she collapsed, screaming, "You dickhead, how could you do this to us? Put us through hell just to go and die." He was lying there, a faint smirk on his face, dry blood under his nose. He left his little girl without a father. Her mum suggested kissing him goodbye to release some of the anger. Kerry thought he didn't deserve it, but as she stared at him, memories flooded in. His voice, his laughter, his fists. The good, the bad, all tangled together. She kissed him, because once he had been her everything, the man who knew her better than anyone, the love of her life and her tormentor. As she turned to leave, she knew she'd never see George K again. She didn't go to the funeral. Fear still clung to her even though he was gone. She said her goodbyes in private and that was enough. Instead, she took the kids to the cinema that day, thanks to her ex, Brian, who quietly sent money to her account. One of the first message her after George's death, and in that moment, someone who showed up when she needed it. It was only after George died that Kerry found out what he'd been up to in those last months. Fueled by rage and armed with fake emails, he had reached out to a group called Fathers for Justice. Now, on the surface, their mission sounds noble. The campaign for changes in UK laws to give fathers more rights, often staging dramatic protests, sometimes even in superhero costumes. And Kerry agreed with the basic idea. Kids need both parents in their lives, but in her mind, that didn't apply to fathers who posed a danger to their families. Giving a violent man access to a child simply because he thinks it's his right, made no sense to her. There are always two sides to every story. After George passed, the founders of Fathers for Justice, Matt O'Connor, published an article on their website. It was full of lies, things George had told them with no proof at all. They never once came to Kerry for her side of the story. So here is what the article said. George K died of a broken heart. He was brokenhearted after being denied access to his beloved daughter, Dylan George, DJ, by his ex, Kerry Katona. Both George and Kerry had well-documented mental health and drug issues. However, she was treated very differently in a way which illustrates the way society supports mothers and abandons fathers. Unlike Kerry, George was punished for having mental health issues. He was punished when Kerry chose to stop him have any access to DJ, exploiting his mental health problems to use against him, safe in the knowledge the courts would turn a blind eye to her issues. I know because he came to Fathers for Justice for help. I know because I too was left suicidal in similar circumstances, unable to cope with the pain and loss of not seeing my children. George told me he was DJ's primary carer much of the time when Kerry was on drink and drug benders or away on publicised holidays organised by her agent. He said there was an abusive pattern to Kerry's behaviour. She would go on a drink and drug bender, leaving all the children, 5 children with 4 different fathers, with him, then have another baby, lose weight, sell her shame story to the press, produce a fitness video and start all over again. In fact, George loved all the children and helped raise them for 6 years. If he was a good enough father then, Why wasn't he after they separated? He said Kerry thought kids equal cash and she had a history of denying her children access to their fathers, having done the same to her ex, Mark Croft. George was a loving dad and a vulnerable adult who needed our love and support. The living bereavement of being separated from his daughter caused him unbearable pain. He begged and begged Kerry and her solicitors for contact with his daughter, but was repeatedly denied any kind of access, including supervised contact. Instead of being supported, he was left broken at the side of the road like countless fathers before him and countless fathers who will follow him. I wish there was more we could have done to help him. I wish there was more everyone could do to help all fathers left in this position. In an age of mental health awareness, we have duty to support separate dads. Now, I feel like I don't even need to go through and break it down and tell you, like, that was all a very manipulative count of everything. And like Kerry said, they didn't ask for her side. They had no proof of what George was saying. Yet they posted this publicly, berating Kerry, slut-shaming her, saying she had 5 kids with 4 different dads, like things like that. It's just really gross. And honestly, just another group of incels, isn't it, really? That's just what I put it as. So after George died, Kerry thought the worst was over, but the online attacks didn't stop. Fathers for Justice kept coming for her and the pressure pushed her to the brink. One day it got so bad her doctor had to give her an injection just to calm her down. She even had moments where she thought maybe it would be easier if she wasn't here at all, with the public believe the lies being told about her. George's death left a huge hole in her life. He'd been all-consuming. The drama, the abuse, the breakups, even the good times, everything had revolved around him. And now, even in death, he'd made it all about himself. She was a shell. She was devastated, angry at him, sad for her kids, guilty that Ryan had to watch her mourn her ex, and confused by how much George's parents seemed to hate her. 2 years later, the inquest into his death finally came around. By then, Kerry was living with Ryan, building a solid future. She'd been happy until the inquest set her back. She hadn't even been invited. She wouldn't have gone out of respect, but still, she was his wife on paper. She felt she should have been there. In the 2 years since his death, George's parents had never once reached out. Kerry had tried, sending messages, videos of DJ dancing, learning to ride her bike, even asking if DJ could have some of his ashes. But nothing. This broke her because DJ adored her grandfather. Kerry didn't know if it was grief that had shut them off or anger over the things George had put them through, but either way, it wasn't DJ's fault. She remembered visiting them just after George died. His father told her that in the weeks before his passing, George had tried to set the house on fire and had hidden in a wardrobe, convinced monsters were coming for him. She realized then that they'd been through hell too, but still, she couldn't understand why they'd snubbed their granddaughter. Then, in 2020, out of nowhere, someone close to the family messaged her. George's dad was very ill, and they added, "If you have any morals about you, you'd let him see DJ." Kerry was floored. This man hadn't wanted to see DJ for years, and now they expected her to take a 7-year-old to say goodbye. She wasn't going to put DJ through that. At an inquest in August 2021, Kerry was blindsided by the statements George's family made about her. They blamed her for his death, even though she hadn't seen him for 18 months. His brother claimed George's drug use had worsened because of her, and that after the separation it got worse still because he couldn't see his child. His mother even suggested Kerry had introduced him to drugs, the same woman who had once warned Kerry not to marry him because he was already an addict. Kerry could understand the instinct to defend her son, but to twist the truth like that, it was a kick in the teeth for her. Hearing the details of his final moments broke her. The image of George walking around asking strangers to be his friend made her cry. She hated thinking of him scared, lonely and desperate. The coroner ruled his death drug-related, not a suicide. That was a relief in a way. And then, that was it. George's story was over. Kerry wished he'd been wired differently. Wished he hadn't been so cruel. Wished he could have been the charming, funny man she'd fallen for all the time. But you can't change the past and you can't change the man. Maybe it was for the best. Life after George was hard, but it lit a fire in her. She vowed never to let herself go through that again. She was going to make her money back, get her career back, love Ryan, love herself, and be the best mother she could be. She was going to come back fighting. George's dad passed away not long after. Kerry was sad for DJ, but even now, she still has no contact with his family. The door, though, is always open if it's in DJ's best interests. The trauma Kerry had endured was impossible to shake. Over time, she noticed her mental health slipping further and further. Some days she barely had the strength to get out of bed. She was grieving, drowning in guilt, and constantly battling her own thoughts. She also found herself reflecting on how the media had treated her over the years, especially when it came to her mental health, and she couldn't understand how it had ever been acceptable. Kerry knew that growing up around abusive men had left deep scars. She'd watched her own mother, Sue, suffer at the hands of a violent partner, and it had nearly destroyed their relationship more than once. Kerry had always promised herself she wouldn't end up like her mum, a woman hardened by life, carrying the weight of her mistakes, but her relationship with George ended up mirroring one her mother had once had with a man named Dan, a convicted murderer who had spent time in prison with the Crays. Dave's violence was extreme. One night he stabbed Sue while screaming that he was Freddy Krueger and was going to mutilate them before chopping them up and putting them in the fridge. He would beat her relentlessly, but despite the horror, he was still the love of her life. They even received a Christmas card from Reggie Cray himself one year. As a child, Kerry would watch her mom endure these beatings and think, "You could go through this a million times, but once would be enough for me." Yet years later, she found herself in the same kind of relationship. She told her mother much later, "I get it now. These men groom you. It's so easy for people on the outside to say, why don't you just leave? But it's not that simple." When Dave died, he was hit by a car. Sue completely broke down. She would sit in her chair and tell Kerry, "That's it. I want to die. I've got nothing left here for me." Those words filled Kerry with dread. What about her? Was her mother really going to take her own life and leave Kerry behind? Sue was deeply damaged by Dave, and because of that, she understood Kerry's complicated feelings after George died. She knew what it was like to be torn between grief and relief. In that way, she became Kerry's rock. All her life, Kerry had been drawn to controlling men, but she knew Ryan was different the moment they met. On her 40th birthday, while on holiday in Spain, he proposed. She was ecstatic, although unfortunately, in 2024, they would break up. If life has taught Kerry anything, it's that she is a survivor. Every hardship she's endured has shaped her into the strong, healthy and happy person she is today. It's taken years of work to truly love herself. For so long, she believed she deserved the pain and the chaos. She thought abuse was normal, so she never questioned whether she deserved better. But she did deserve better, and it took every ounce of strength to walk away from George. It wasn't easy. In fact, surviving the hell he put her through was the hardest thing she's ever done. But she's still here. She's free. And her message to anyone going through something similar is simple. You are not alone. Don't give up. There is always a way out. All right, guys, we did it. Another episode down. Sorry, about halfway through that, my voice started to get really hoarse. And it's been like that for the last few weeks since I'm getting over this like cold and cough that I had. But yeah, I just thought that was a great example of a story of how it is so hard to leave, and it takes sometimes several attempts before you really get there to the end. And each time you think like you're done and now that's it, and you think you're over, but like something always sucks you back in. So I just thought that was a great example of it, and especially the fact that like it can literally happen to anyone. Kerry, she's a famous woman in the public eye. She could have told people, she had money, she had opportunities, she could have done something. No, it doesn't matter. It does not matter who you are, what you do for work, where you come from. It does not matter. And Kerry was just particularly vulnerable to it because she had been abused all her life and treated terribly all her life and seen her mom be treated terribly all her life and be abused. So I just think it's a really great example of that. And props to Kerry for being so honest and telling her story. Especially being in the public eye, it's really important, I think, for us to see women like that having gone through similar circumstances. And anyone listening, I'm sorry this was a repeat episode, but it is kind of different because I did kind of like, I wrote it differently and like chopped and changed some things around, so it's not the exact same. And obviously I had a guest on the last time, so it's a little different anyway. I just wanted the sound quality to be a little better. I'm trying to make it easy to listen to. If you're, you know, if you started off listening to my podcast, you can kind of gradually see how the quality's gotten better. But if you're kind of new to it, you know, it can be kind of annoying. Like, I know if you're a podcast listener in general, like, there's so many podcasts I listen to where I'll listen to the episodes from the beginning, and like the sound quality improves so much as they become more, you know, used to the process and like learning more about it. And then also, like, you know, inevitably when they're making money from the podcast and, like, you know, they can afford the better equipment and all the rest of it. So I'm just trying to, like, I still don't know if I want to re-record. I don't know. I feel like I probably won't do it, but I might go back and have a listen and see just like how bad it actually is. If it's terrible, then maybe I might do that. But anyways, guys, thanks for listening. I hope you guys have a great week, and, well, let's face it, it'll probably be a good month or so by the time you hear from me again. I always say have a great week, like I'm going to be here again next week, and then inevitably I never get around to doing another episode. It's so bad, there's always something. But I have a fun week coming up. I'm going to see Oasis on Monday here in New York, which I'm so excited about. Oh my god, I'm so excited about it. I have actually got a funny story to tell you about that, but I'm not going to tell you right now because I've already rambled on for too long. So maybe next time after I've already been to the concert, I'll fill you in on that. It's really funny. But anyways, have a great week, month, or however long it's going to be since you hear from me again. Until you hear from me again, I mean. And once again, always feel free to reach out to me. All the info is in my bio about my Instagram, Twitter, etc., at Mangogs, ipvandmepodcast@gmail.com. If you want to email me, DMs are always open, etc. Reach out to thehotline.org for any help or any extra information. And if you want to be a guest on the podcast, always welcome guests. I have some fun ones coming up very shortly, which I'm very excited about. And, you know, again, always reach out to me. The email is probably the best way, but even if it is through Instagram, that's totally fine also. And yeah, just have a fun, safe few weeks, and I will see you again next time. Bye.